And I want to acknowledge the contribution of André Lévesque, historian at McGill, who put a great deal of work, patience, and persistence in developing what this book has been in a conference and the following publication of books. I want to say that when we started out organizing in 1942, Kent Rowley and I, Quebec wasn't the Quebec of today. People in many provinces said, oh, Quebec is priesthood-ridden. What can you do with that? And the fact was that when workers organized, especially where there were women involved and children, you were up against not only the employers, but against Maurice Duplessis in the long number of years that he presided over the affairs of Quebec. And he did it in partnership with the church to keep people in their place. When the British conquered Canada, deported Acadians and Gaspésians and some others, the church eventually made a pact with the British Crown to the effect that if they were given authority over the religion of our people and the schools, they would see to it that our people bowed to the crown. And that was the situation for a very long time. In the cotton mills, which began in Quebec in the 1800s, by at least 1870, from then on, there were a number of arguments, complaints about the horrible conditions, about the exploitation, particularly of women and children. And some of these arguments ended up in strikes. And every time, it wasn't the workers who negotiated a settlement, the parish priest or another priest came to the fore, gathered a few businessmen around him, making sure that one at least spoke English for the bosses. And they negotiated and then told the workers, this is what we have or what we haven't got, and go back to work. So they were never able to make a decision of their own. In 1937, the Catholic syndicates, which were not what we have today in the Confederation of National Trade Unions, which is a magnificent organization. But in those days, it was run by the church. And when there was a general strike in the Depression of 1937, after 3 weeks of struggle in nearly all of the mills in Quebec, and it was a big industry, the Cardinal Villeneuve, and the head of the Catholic Union, and the local members of the Quebec Assembly told the workers to go back to work. There was no contract. Duplessis said, I'll bring you a law which will solve your problems. Well, the law came later after the strike had been broken, and it wasn't any better than the previous law they had before. So there was a lot of discouragement, even though some people stood up, tried to warn their brothers and sisters not to accept and to keep on striking. But the strength of those who ran the country was too great, and people caved in. We came along in 42 in the war. And I must say, the AFL leaders were not favorable to that. They appointed Kent to go and organize a war factory, and he chose one in Valleyfield and said, all right, in my spare time, can I do what I want? Oh, you can do what you want. Who cares? Well, in his spare time, he visited cotton mill workers. And the organization developed. We had a majority in a few months. It was the biggest cotton mill in Canada. And then proceedings started under war measures. So it was with the federal government at the time. And we were certified, of course. There was conciliation. There was a further committee of the government set up. But none of them had powers. And the company absolutely refused to do anything about it and refused to discuss with the union. I was appointed to go out and work with the workers in the Montreal cotton mills, where there were another 3,000 workers. And we organized, we got certifications, and the company went no farther again. So it was obvious that there would have to be a strike. There was no other choice. If we looked at the conditions in the mills, the wages were very low. Women worked 10 hours a day or night, and so did children. And I met a number of children of 12, 13, 14 years of age, and their conditions were very precarious. There were accidents with children wanting to tie knots and grab a piece of thread that had gone astray and not thinking that they had to wait until a machine was stopped. So some of them fell and had very serious accidents. Well, they organized in a few months in Montreal. We were certified. And we were told by the AFL people, oh, women and children can never organize. You know what happened in 37. Well, the women organized. And since they looked after the children in the mills, the children followed them. And they voted as the women voted. And they acted as the women wanted them to act. They were no problem. It was difficult because by the time the war was nearing an end, then we were not under wartime regulations, which were bad enough, except that Mr. C.D. Howe didn't want strikes, and there were some things which he forbade, such as firing workers because of unions. So we had that extra protection. When we came back in Quebec under the Du Plessis regime, we no longer had that protection. And he was just as vicious as he had been before the war. In 46, we struck 6,000 cotton mill workers in Montreal and Valleyfield. And it was very long, very difficult. And the company absolutely refused to meet with us. They would meet with our international secretary treasurer from Washington, who subsequently sold out the workers anyway, so they knew who they were dealing with. However, in spite of all of that, we got a settlement of the strike in Montreal, not yet in Valleyfield. And so we decided in the Joint Strike Committee, to try to persuade the workers of Valleyfield to release those of Montreal of their solidarity pledge and to go in and take advantage of the first contract that was signed with the Dominion Textiles. It was very, very difficult for them, but they agreed. And that's when the company really pounced on the Valleyfield people. Of course, the church would call scabs to mass in the morning with the promise that when there were enough scabs gone to mass, that they would be escorted to the plant and taken over by strong-armed men of the company and the provincial police who would lead them in. Well, this happened for 3 days with a small number of scabs, and on the third day, the mothers and wives of the strikers, who were always welcome at the strike meetings and who were a very active group, who wouldn't choose to go and sit with their husband or their daughter or son, they would meet and sit together and be a voice in the union meetings, which was very good. But they decided that on the third day, they'd leave their homes and join us on the picket line, so that by the time the scabs were to be ushered out at noon, because they'd have to go past our lines 4 times in the day, the company wasn't satisfied that they'd just go in, there were 5,000 people at the plant gates and surrounding the mill. So that eventually, with the fight between the police and the strikers, the police negotiated with Kent and one of the partners, and they agreed that if we would protect the scabs coming out with the support of the police, that they would close the mill gates and there would be no longer that kind of thing, which happened. But of course, after 2 or 3 days, Kent was picked up in the middle of the night, and he was in jail until the end of the strike, which was another 3 weeks. However, the strike was won eventually, and workers would refer to that period as the time we won our freedom. And meaning that not only could they negotiate and get somewhat better conditions, which were not extraordinary, but they were union conditions, they could complain, they could grieve, they could, they were free to do what they felt was right. However, eventually, of course, the after the war, as years went on, and there was a reaction, an attempt to bring us back to the olden days, and the American Union betrayed us, and the CIA came in the person of a new Canadian director, Sam Baron, who was a CIA agent. And the people were sold out. Well, do you know that even for a good 3 weeks after that, that was in 52, workers didn't go into the plant. We had no legal rights anymore. We had no status. We were being attacked. But the workers still wouldn't go over to those who were selling them out. Eventually, of course, there was no other choice. But that was one story. Altogether, we managed to have about 25,000 people organized in the textile industry, mainly in Quebec and in Ontario, and some in the Maritime provinces at the time. I think the finest experience one could have was when workers who had worked so long under terrible difficulties and failed to have confidence in themselves, in rights which we had on paper, but which they ignored and which were not put in practice. And in the course of union meetings and in contacts and in discussions, they began to discover that they were persons and they must have rights, but they had to get together and claim those rights. A feeling that, yes, I am somebody and I'm not a slave, but I've got to go out and make sure that that happens. And that kind of solidarity and discovery of their significance and of their humanity, I think, was one of the finest things. And I remember one woman when she was an immigrant in a Toronto strike we had, and we had negotiated all night until 4:30 in the morning with the employer. And we got a settlement because they were scared of Italian women. Anyway, the women were ready to picket, and we said, well, we've got a paper, and if you'll go to work for another day, we'll hold a meeting, and then you can judge whether you still want to strike or whether you want to settle. But I said to this woman, you know, the company president and his brother-in-law were so scared in the night. She said, we've been scared long enough, and now that we're together, we're not going to be scared anymore. These are some of the things that that mean so much in organization, and some of the things that unfortunately governments and the friends of the corporations fear so much, the awakening of people and their developing a conscience that they have rights to. And since they do the production, they don't want them ever to be able to control the production. So it's been a great experience, and I still have it in activities that I'm able to participate in Quebec particularly. When Bush was, well, he's always pressuring Canadians, but when he was particularly pressuring Canada to send soldiers against the people of Iraq, we had one demonstration in Montreal of 250,000 people saying we don't want to go to war against the people of Iraq or any other peoples. And in other towns in and around in Quebec, Sherbrooke, Quebec City, Three Rivers, the North Country where mining is prevalent and so on, there were another 40 to 50,000 people demonstrating in their own towns. So you had about 300,000 workers. And Chrétien, who was no hero, had to tell Bush, we won't send Canadians to the war in Iraq. And of course, there were demonstrations here and in many other places. But there was an actual mass revolt in Quebec on the question of sending soldiers overseas for American imperialist wars. So that's where I live right now, back home. And it is very enjoyable to live that way. I know that many people feel that Quebec is threatening the unity of Canada. But what kind of unity do we have in Canada right now? What are the politicians doing with our people? And I say that since the people of Quebec want sovereignty, that if only we'll understand that it's so that they can choose their own representatives and make their own decisions in the interest of their own welfare. And if we respect that elsewhere, there will be unity in purpose of people in English Canada and people in Quebec for peace, against the domination by the U.S. of our own affairs. And we will be closer in that kind of unity in action than we will be fighting and disagreeing with each other all the time. And I would ask you to think about that In the book, Rick Salutin says, in Madeline's mind, there was no contradiction between fighting for independence of Canada, meaning against U.S. imperialism, and fighting for the independence of Quebec. And that's what I mean, and I hope you will stop and think about it and help us to make this kind of agreement amongst each other on common purposes for the welfare of our own people and for our contribution to peace in the world. Right now, the U.S., whether we, the politicians, agree or not, are taking up our skies to militarize them. And our politicians are not telling us how far they are committed in this terrible venture. It doesn't mean more peace for us. It means that we would be more vulnerable to all kinds of attacks. And it means a domination, a further domination of the U.S. military and powers. So I would ask you to think about all these things. I thank you for coming, and let's all fight for peace.